Good morning. So, for break, we're talking about some distributed systems related things. So one idea was we had our socket abstraction, which is basically pipes over the network. And we had this other idea where we could have something that looks like function calls, but actually calls something over the network. And the implementation of this is that we have this sort of little compiler where we gave a description of the functions we wanted called, and it created the code for both the server and the client being what calls the functions, the server being where the functions are called, that deals with translating the arguments to something that we could send over sockets and back and translating the return value in the same way, and so on. And based on this, we started talking about network file systems. And we talked about NFS, the network file system, back when we didn't think we needed to have unique names for that. And the basic idea was that NFS turned file operations into remote procedure calls. But the obvious way of doing that didn't really work out because we didn't want to keep track of all the file descriptors on the server. That's a lot of file descriptors. And it also made it really hard to think about what do we do if a client goes away, like when can we get rid of the information about the file descriptors. So NFS had this alternate idea, which was to operate statelessly. That the server would give file IDs, which would typically contain something like the IDO number, so the server didn't need to remember what client files the client had opened, the client just told them, here's the file you previously told me about, and it could look it up without tracking this information that, besides information that's already in the file system, like what inode has, like data. And this dealt with that sort of failure problem that when the server failed, well, it wasn't remembering anything but what was on the file system anyways. When the client failed, the client's information about what file descriptors were open just went away. We didn't have to worry about cleaning it up or anything like that. We talked about caching in this. So simply forwarding all the operations turns out to be really, really slow. We do lots of little file reads and writes, and the network is not nearly as fast as a system call. And usually locally we're used to that, well, though the disk is slow, the system calls for reading and writing files usually access the cache, and so usually quite fast. So we needed some way of actually caching data that was practical, but still kept things consistent. And with this stateless model, well, we were saying that we're not going to have the server store information about what files are open, so that makes consistency tricky, because the server then doesn't want to store information about what files do clients have cached. And the solution NFS chose, which is a reasonably popular solution, is to say, well, I don't really care that the cache is consistent, I'm just going to make sure that it's consistent enough. And consistent enough was that we're going to guarantee that as long as two people don't open the file at the same time, they'll have a consistent view, and we'll do this by double checking on open and making sure we write everything back to the server on close. And maybe we'll do a little extra work of like pure syncing every 3 seconds or something like that to make sure that in cases where you keep files open for a long time, it doesn't get too out of whack. We also talked about a strategy where if you said, well, maybe I don't care about making my server not remember anything, and this was to have callbacks rather than having the clients proactively say, is this file updated now, every time it gets opened again and they have it cached or something like that. Have a way for the client to say, please tell me if you get an update for the file. And this makes the cache updating situation better, so at least we learn immediately when there's a write to the server. Problem is that, you know, this is not immediately when the write happens, if the write's cached and then sent to the server later on. So we still had close to open consistency unless we were going to decide that, no, I'm going to do all writes immediately to the server, even though that's slow. So any questions about things we covered last time? Okay, so since I talked about close to open consistency, I'd like to talk about sort of a practical issue, which is that we learned that the way NFS keeps files consistent seems horribly difficult to use if you actually have to worry about two programs might be opening the same file at the same time. So what can you do? So one idea would be file locking. So there's some mechanism of like something like locks for files. I don't know. Oh, right. I have something on offline operation because I originally planned to have extra slides. But if you're connected to a file server, you have conflicting rights, you can do file locking. So file locking, the idea is we have a lock, sort of a mutex, associated with each file. And this is a feature that, for example, POSIX and most OSs provide. But it doesn't work with network file systems sometimes. And I say sometimes because really it is really hard to figure out whether it works or not. Like it's kind of supposed to work and reports are mixed. But there is locking. And the POSIX interface, there's this fcnflock struct, and you can use this fcntl call to obtain a lock. There's a read lock and a write lock. So here I have an example of a write lock. And these locks are over a range of bytes in the file. So it's as if each byte has its own lock, but obviously it's implemented in a way where they're like there's a list of locks, and the lock call checks that list and sees if there's a conflict and waits if there is, and so on. So this is something that's implemented, and locally, this will work perfectly. That you can use this to say, if you have two processes accessing a file, you open the file, you call this, do this lock, and then you're guaranteed that you access it one at a time, and as long as you make sure you actually make your write system calls before you release the lock, no one's going to see inconsistent data on a local machine. And sometimes this will work right on NFS. Depending on how NFS is configured, sometimes it won't. To make it work on NFS, we obviously need things we didn't talk about because we need state on the server. We need the server to remember who has the file locked. And that's not always configured. So that's not part of the protocol we talked about. That's an extension. That's not always implemented. So questions on idea. So this is our file locking. So the idea is we make this lock, this is our RW lock call. If you remember, probably we were reader writer lock, RW lock, and this is our relier lock unlock call, just like we had a reader writer lock for the file. And this is an advisory lock. So a big thing that trips people up looking at these file locking APIs is people say, oh, the file's locked, that means you can't read it. That's not how these locks work. That's not how most file locking APIs work. The way it works is that you have to use the lock. If you don't use the lock, it's not going to stop you from accessing the file. This is the same way if you have a struct with a mutex and you don't use the mutex, you can still read things in the struct. You just might get weird results. Same thing is true with these file locks. Even though they're associated with the file, you have to opt into them. If someone using the file isn't opting in, they're going to see inconsistent data sometimes. And that's too bad. And so these are file locks. So they're useful. They're something you should keep in mind if you actually want to write code where two programs access a file. Unfortunately, the POSIX APIs are way uglier than I like. So like, this code, not very elegant. We have to make this funny struct, and so on. There's another API which uses flock, which is a little more elegant, but is less likely to work over NFS. And the fcntl API has like all these non-intuitive things, like it's not inherited by fork, just because that's something. And if you have multiple copies of the file open and close any one of them, it releases the lock. which doesn't make any sense, just bad API design, but we're stuck with it because it's written in the standard and they can't change it now. Because there's probably some program somewhere that relies on it. But sometimes this works over NFS, and that's because there's a separate lock server to make it work, usually. Now, there's another solution, which is what you use when you figure out that these APIs are horrible and that they don't really work over a network file system, and this is lock files. So the way lock files work is that you create a, choose a file name that's related to your file. So like you might add .lock to the file, or you can choose some other name that's more invisible to the user, like you can put it in a temporary directory. And you create a lock file with the link command, which remember link makes another directory entry that points to the same file as another one, as an old one, or open with oexclude. And the way these work is that these say, create this file, with link create another directory entry that's the same file as one I had before, with open with oexclusive create a new file, but only if it didn't already exist with that name, like don't overwrite a file. And these both fail, should fail if file, these fail if lock file exists, is the idea. So you're creating the file, and the idea is you try to create this lock file that didn't already exist using a something which is going to fail if it already existed. So that's your lock operation, and if that fails, that means someone else locked before you. And you try again later or give up. There's no nice way. And this even works over NFS because these are single RPC calls which return a value about whether they're successful or not. So you don't have to worry about things being out of sync. It's not about data in the file. We're just giving a call to create a file, and that's going to say, sorry, you couldn't create the file, or giving a call to link a file, and that's going to say, sorry, this didn't work. And then when you want to unlock the file, you remove the lock file. And hopefully your program doesn't crash while you have the lock, because then that lock file is never going to be removed and everything will fail. So this is the most practical scheme if you actually need to do locking that works on a network file system. And it's what a lot of programs do to deal with handling, you know, I need to worry about two copies of my program running at the same time. I need to make that work. This is typically what you do to make that work. So you have this lock file so you know only one's happening at a time, so the other one can at least give a message saying, sorry, you're running another instance of this. Wait for later. So questions about file locking? Very quiet class today. So things are either really clear or really not clear. Okay, so that's the end of my digression into file locking. So I'm going to go into a different topic on distributed systems, which is dealing with failure sort of more systematically. And to do this, I'd like to talk about sort of how machines fail as a brief interlude. And we're mostly going to be dealing with a simple model of failure that makes things easier to reason about. So there's two models that you'll commonly see going around, and you might say, well, gosh, there's a lot missing in between these. So one is called fail stop. And the notion of fail stop is that if a machine has failed, it stops responding. So this matches our notion that maybe the most common cause of failure is the network breaks. That's exactly the machine stops responding. And a lot of other failures look this way if we squint in the right way. Like, for example, if a disk fails on your machine, maybe it doesn't stop responding, but it might as well have. So you can use this fail stop model. You can pretend it's the same as the machine being unplugged from the network as long as you detect the failure and know the machine's bad. This is a common proposal for dealing with many types of failures, is that we're going to do everything as if when the machine fails, it gets disconnected from the network, even if that's not really what happens. Even if really what happens is we detect something's wrong with this machine, I'm just going to ignore what's happening to it, but we'll treat it as if we unplugged it from the network. So there's another model, which is called Byzantine failures. And in the Byzantine failure model, the failing machine looks at all the things it could possibly do and chooses the one which is most inconvenient for you. Whatever that is, that's what it's going to choose every time. The most inconvenient possible thing, it's going to maliciously figure out what you would do that would mess you up the worst, and it's going to do that. So this includes things like telling one machine, yeah, I have this data, and telling another machine, yeah, it's this other data for the same file, for example. All sorts of things going wrong. And the nice thing about the Byzantine failure model is that if you can make a system which works, if you assume failures work this way, if you can mathematically prove that it's going to behave correctly, assuming some number of machines have this kind of failure, then, that system should work no matter what happens. The nice thing about the fail-stop model is that it's pretty practical, and most of us believe that most failures fall in that kind of model. But we know that some failures are going to be things like the machine gives you the wrong data, which is not the fail-stop model. So these are our models of failure, and in a distributed system, we often want to deal with some number of machines failing in either one of these ways. And there's two basic strategies that people use for this. So one is sort of the recovery model, is that when the machines or some of the machines come back up, we're gonna figure out what happened. So this is what we've talked about for file systems. We have redo logging, so we know that things are in a good state. When machines come back up, that's how we're dealing with failures. So that's sort of the fail-stop idea, that we don't assume that when things with redo logging fail, that we haven't written data to the disk we don't expect. And when they come back up, we can recover the state, and that's how we get back to working. So this is we're dealing with failures, but we're not continuing to work on failures. We lose what's known as availability, that our system's unavailable, but at least our data is intact and everything's in a consistent state. If you want to deal with availability, keep system, you can rely on what we'll call a quorum of machines working. So for fail-stop, if you want to deal with one failure, you need at least two machines to do that. So you need some extra machines to deal with things working. So if you want to deal with so many number of machines failing, you need an extra machine for fail-stop, at least. For Byzantine failures, there's a result that I will not prove, that if you want to deal with F machines failing, you need 3F+1 machines in order to maintain a consistent state. I'm not going to prove that. That is not an easy thing to prove. That is a well-known result, assuming a typical model of how systems work. And which is another reason people don't like the Byzantine failure model, because all of a sudden, to deal with one machine failing, I need 4 of them, 3 of which have to be working correctly. So we're going to start by handling this scenario. And this is going to be sort of extending our idea of redo logging. That for redo logging, we were handling recovering when things came back up for a single machine. Here I want to do the same thing, but for multiple machines which are doing something together. And I'm going to do this with dealing with the question of a distributed transaction, so that we're going to have two machines, or maybe more than two machines, both agree to do something or not do something. And we want this agreement to like work out consistently, even if the machine fails in the middle. We're going to assume the fail stop model. We basically can't do this in the non-fail stop model, because with Byzantine failures, like one of the machines can always just refuse to do it ever and lie about it. But with fail stop, we know that the machine's either going to do what it says it's going to do, or it's going to disconnect itself from the network until it comes back, until we fix it. So the idea is that we'll have the machine agree to do something or not do something such that, you know, it will get done eventually when we fix the machine. We don't have to worry about one machine doing the thing and the other machine not remembering to do the thing. Or worse, doing something that's contradicts that thing. Like if we're saying we're writing to a file, both machines are going to agree to write A to the file. We're not going to have one machine write A to the file, one machine write B to the file, and then read the file and not know what's in it. And I'm going to give a more concrete example that I'm going to use to sort of illustrate why you might want to do this. So let's say we have a database for courses, and we have it split across many machines because it's a big database, and we wanted to buy nice cheap machines to put it on. So I have two machines, machines A and B, hold the student records. So I have all the records for the students, and I have machine C, which holds the course records. And I want to add student to a course. And to do that, machine A or B needs to do something. So let's say the student record for that student is on machine A, and machine C needs to do something. And they better both agree to do it or not. We don't want someone to say, am I in this course, and give them the wrong answer. So when someone asks the student records machine, am I in this course, they're going to get the right answer. When someone asks the course record machines, is this student in this course, they're going to get the same answer. That's what we want to guarantee. That even though we split up this task across two machines that have different parts, that their information is going to be consistent, that there's no confusion about what student is in the course, even if we power off one of the machines while it's writing this update. So this problem makes sense? Yeah.
I don't understand why it guarantees that's right to the course of the transaction. Because if machine A is doing half of the student records, machine B is doing half of the student records.
So the question you have is how can we guarantee this if the transaction split up? So the big trick we're going to use is that sometimes when you ask as a student in the course, we're not going to give you an answer until later. We're going to say we're in the middle of figuring that out. So that's how we can keep that consistent. So we're going to have this extra state, which is something is changing, basically. So yes, there's going to be redo logging. That is how it's going to work. Other questions? Yeah, but before I talk about that machine doing redo logging, I'm going to talk about the simplest solution to this problem, which is a centralized solution. We're going to have a new machine D, and machine D is going to maintain a redo log for all operations. And whenever a machine goes down, machine D is going to redo those operations and everything. That's one solution to this problem. And this machine D is going to be what we're going to use to do all the queries of, is a student in the course? So we're actually going to go to machine D, ask, is the student in the course? Machine D is going to use the records on machines A, B, and C, but it's just going to treat them as dumb data storage. So that's one solution. This solution's pretty unsatisfying. Mainly because, we'd probably, if we're splitting up the database across multiple machines, we want the machines to be doing work. We want them to actually be answering queries about who's in the course and all that sort of stuff, rather than having the centralized bottleneck, because that kind of destroys the point of having separate machines for everything. We would just, we're just basically treating it like these machines are machine D's extra disks. So So we're going to have each machine be responsible just for their own data, and we're only going to coordinate when a transaction crosses the machine. So I'm just going to talk about what we have to do when we're doing something like changing a student and a course at the same time. All the operations which only change one thing are still going to be independent to one machine, so we're going to get most of the advantage we have of separate machines. That if you just want to make changes to student records, they only talk to the student record machines. You don't have to also talk to the course record machines. You just want to make changes to the course, you only have to talk to the course record machine. You don't have to talk to the student record machine. So we have a lot of advantage to actually splitting up our records still. And we're only going to coordinate with the involved machine. So we don't have a single central machine, meaning that if I have student records on machine A, that I don't need to talk to machine B, which has the other student records, to do anything with them, even if that involves two machines. And as was alluded to, we're going to use a persistent lock. So we're going to rely on the machines being able to remember what happened on failure. So they're going to remember something about where they were if something failed, just like we saw with file systems, that we're going to have something we remember. And it's going to be a redo lock. So we're going to record things that we've intended to do but haven't done yet in the log. And on reboot, the machine's going to redo those things. But unlike for a file system, these are going to be things where we talk to other machines. So we're going to record, what are we going to tell these other machines in our redo log? So when we come back up, we remember what we were going to tell the other machines. And this is going to deal with the issue that, well, I don't know if I finished contacting those other machines when I went down. So we're just going to tell them again, and they'll figure out if we told them multiple times, that's not going to be a problem. Okay. So questions on this basic idea here? So the way of implementing these distributed transactions I'm going to describe is something called two-phase commit. And the setup here is that every machine that's involved is going to vote on the transaction. So there's going to be two phases. The first phase is voting. The second phase is actually doing something. And in the voting phase, the machine is going to vote to either commit to do the operation, like to add the student to the class, or to abort, to say, don't do it, something went wrong, I don't know what to do. So this could be, this could be, I failed. This could be, the class is full. There could be lots of reasons to abort, but wherever the machine's constraints are, like, it's going to choose whether to commit or abort. And it's going to vote on that. And if we have unanimity, if all machines agree to commit, we're going to actually commit in the second phase of this protocol. So, questions so far? So, we have these two phases. So, phase one we're going to call preparing. So, this is where the machines state their intention. They learn what the intended operation is. I want to add this student to this class. They figure out, can I do that? Is the class full? Do I have some conflicting add that I don't know what's going to happen? And so on. And we have this second phase where they figure out whether it's going to actually happen and then update their database. So in the preparing phase, each machine's going to send a message for the transaction, either agree to commit or agree to abort. And these messages are promises. This is why this protocol works, is that when the machines make their vote, they're not just saying what they want to happen to the transaction, they're making a guarantee about what their behavior is going to be. And in order to keep this guarantee, we're going to need redo logging. So the machine's going to write down what their promise is, so they're not going to forget it, even if they fail. So if they agree to commit, they're going to record that in the log. So when they come back up, they know, yes, I agreed. I would like to commit this transaction. If they agree to abort, they're going to record in their log, I agreed, I will not let this transaction happen. And they're going to remember that no matter what. And they're never going to take it back. So if you get a message from a machine saying, I agree to abort this transaction, you're never going to have that machine tell you later on, no, it's okay, I'm going to commit it. If you want to do the operation again, you have to use a new transaction. And the agree to the commit message is this promise that I will accept this transaction. So we don't know when we agree to commit that the transaction will actually happen. Because the other machine might say no. The other machine might say, sorry, the class is full, or sorry, I'm out of disk space, I can't do this. But this is a promise that I will make this let this transaction happen if you tell me it commits. And to keep this promise, not only do we need to record that we've made the promise, we need to make sure no interfering operations happen. So for example, if we're adding a student to the course, we need to make sure that there's a space in that course until we figure out whether this is committing or aborting. So we have to reserve that slot while this transaction is pending. And that's how we keep one of the ways we keep consistency here. Another thing we might do is if we care about telling people accurately whether they're in the class or not, we're not going to give them a definite answer while we're in this agree to commit state. Yeah?
So is that how you handle like synchronization issues if like there's one seat left in a class and two students try and get into that seat almost at the same time?
So this would be how you handle it if they were split across multiple machines. So most likely, our course database is on one machine in reality. But if you had to split it across multiple machines, this would be, yes, how you handle it.
Because I was thinking, like, what if the machines say they can all, like, into it?
Yeah, so they're not allowed to say that if it would cause an inconsistency that we have to have them reject it. And that's part of, yeah, that's how you deal with those types of constraints. So basically, one way you can look at this is the simplest way of implementing this is that when you agree to commit, you acquire a lock on the course.
Okay, yeah, that's
better. You might want to do something better than that, like because if the course is not full, you can still add people in parallel. But the simplest way to implement this no interfering operations is that when you agree to commit, you acquire the lock on the course. If you're the course server, you acquire a lock on the student. If you're the student server, and while you're figuring out whether it's committing or not, you don't let anyone else change the course or the student. And this is a disadvantage of this design, which is that if you want to do multiple things to the same object, you have to wait. But that means that we keep this consistency guarantee. So, other questions? So then we have our finishing step. So in our finishing step, we're going to learn what the other machines voted. I'll talk about the mechanism for that in a bit. And if we learn all machines agreed to commit, we're going to actually commit the transaction. So we're going to apply the transaction and record that decision in our local log. So if we have a failure, we'll actually record it first and then apply the transaction. So if we have a failure, we'll redo the operation. And if we learn any machine agreed to abort, we're going to abort the transaction, so we're going to unapply the transaction. If we have a lock on the course, we're going to unlock it now without having made that change. So we might have said, sorry, I can't add you to the course because we had the transaction locked. But you know, that's sort of a consequence of doing this synchronization. And, you know, in the worst case, you can keep asking people what they need to do. So if you don't know what everyone is doing, you can just ask them again and again because they've remembered their decision. So even if we lose messages, We always have a way of learning this outcome, that we can just keep asking people, like, even if the network goes down temporarily while they're telling us, hey, I agreed to commit, it's okay, they've remembered it in their log. They can look it up for us. So we're talking about blocking. So two-phase commit is a particular design choice, which is that when a machine goes away, the state is uncertain, and you know, we might never resolve what happens. That when things are, when a machine goes away, we have some transactions we've agreed to commit, so we have promised to never let things go inconsistent with that transaction happening, but we don't know whether it's going to happen. And this is going to stay that way indefinitely until the machine comes back. And let's say the machine failed forever, like the disk is broken, and we can't recover the data. Well, in that case, we're going to need manual intervention to fix it. Yeah?
When you say machine goes away, as in, it fails during the preparing phase? Or?
Yeah, so if a machine fails during the preparing phase, we're going to need manual intervention to decide what happens. Yeah?
What if one of the machines goes to like a Byzantine failure?
So the question is, what happens with Byzantine failures? So Byzantine failures are horrible for this model. So I guess I mentioned, like, you can just ask people over and over again what they need to do. That assumes that the machine, once it tells you I've agreed to commit, it's going to keep telling you that. An example of a Byzantine failure is that a machine tells you the first time I agreed to commit, and then tells you I agreed to abort every other time. And that's going to cause horrible problems for this protocol. So a protocol that handles Byzantine failures is way more complicated because of that. Because that's like the biggest issue you have to deal with, is that a machine tells you, yes, I'm going to do this at one point in time, then tells you, no, I'm not, and then it goes back to telling you, yes, I am. And you have to still make the system work. Okay. So I'm going to talk about this protocol more concretely. And to do this, I'm going to talk about different roles. So the way I phrased things previously, it sounded like all the machine workers contact each other. In a typical implementation of this protocol, we're going to designate one machine as a coordinator for each transaction. Now, if there's multiple transactions, like if different students are adding themselves to different classes, the coordinators could all be different machines. But we just have one machine for every transaction that's responsible for asking for votes, collecting the votes, and so on. This could be the same machine as one of the servers that's storing the data, but for simplicity, we'll draw it as if it's a different machine. And we'll call the machines which actually store the data the workers. And I'm going to describe this in terms of messages. So our protocol is going to look like this. The coordinator is going to contact all the workers and send a message we'll call prepare. And this is going to say, hey, will you agree to do this action? Please give me your votes. This is the transaction I'd like to do. Do you want to do it? And for each of these messages, we're going to have to think about what happens if we try to send this message and it doesn't get there, either because one of the machines went away or because the network failed. For this message, it's going to be okay to send it multiple times. To make that happen, we're going to have a transaction ID. So we can tell that it's the same message, and the machine receiving it can say, oh, I already got this message, and here's the promise I made for that. I'm going to send that to you again. So on a failure, we can figure out, did we see this before or not in our log, and use that. And then the worker sends to the coordinator, I either vote to commit or I vote to abort. And before it sends any of this message, it records the result in the log, so it's going to be consistent. So it makes sure it returns the same result each time. Then once the coordinator's gotten all the votes, the coordinator sends, hey, everyone's agreed to commit, everyone's agreed to abort. Or not everyone's agreed, but enough people have agreed to abort that we're aborting. So it sends what the global decision is the transaction committing or aborting to each of the workers. So questions about this flow? Yeah.
So this just allows you to like scale it to as many workers as you want, right?
So the question is why the coordinator?
Yeah.
The reason for the coordinator is that it makes it scale to more workers better. Because if we had each worker asking every other worker, what's your votes, that would work, but then we have n squared messages, here we have order n messages, which is way better when we have like 10 workers. It also makes it simpler to implement in practice, yeah.
So when the coordinator tells a worker the global, what they agreed on, what happens if the worker then fails?
So what happens if the worker then fails? So I'll try to go through most of the failure cases. So if the coordinator tells the worker, hey, everyone agreed to commit, and the worker fails, so there's two possibilities. So one possibility is the worker comes back up, it reads its log, and it finds out, oh, I voted to commit on this thing, but I don't know what happened. So what it can do in that case is it can ask the worker, so one solution is it could ask the worker, hey, what happened? And the worker can resend its commit message. Another solution to the problem is that the worker can look for an ACK and send a reply and keep sending the message until the worker says, yes, I got your commit message. But it's going to be something where one of the machines notices something's not right and asks for a repeat of the message. And in order to make that work, one of the things we're going to end up doing is that the coordinator is going to have a log where it stores did I start sending commit or abort messages, so it knows how to reply to that. Hey, what happened to this transaction? I just came back up after failing. Message. Yeah.
Is the coordinator going to keep track of like ask for? Oh, did you finish this yet to the workers or no?
So in practice, the coordinator is going to want to eventually clean up its log. So it's going to figure that out eventually. I don't actually talk about that on my slides, but in practice, that's one of the things we want to do is like clean up old log entries. So one thing that a real implementation of this protocol will do is figure out when everyone's actually done committing, so you can not have to remember your vote committed, vote aborts forever. Because otherwise you would, right? You don't know when you don't need them anymore. I'm just going to gloss over that step, but it is a real step in implementing this in practice. Okay. So when we talk about protocols like this, typically we want to have a nice concrete way of reasoning about protocol correctness. And usually what you'll see in practice is state machines. And the big advantage of state machines is that we can easily simulate this. We can like say we're in state this, and we can look in each state and say, well, if I get this message, what happens? If I get this message, what happens? So we can enumerate all the possibilities. And this is good for testing protocol correctness. Because, well, two-phase commit is something where you can probably look at it carefully and look at all the failure cases. That's a lot of work, and you could miss something. Like, you could have missed some case where something fails, and you need to know if you're handling it. And when we're talking about protocols which deal with more interesting failures, like we mentioned Byzantine failures, it's an absolute disaster without something where you can like formally reason about it and do proofs and do simulations where you know you're handling all the cases and so on. So a state machine is helpful for that, both for implementing the protocol and describing it, and for also verifying that it does what you want to do in all the cases, making sure you didn't miss a case, because now with a state machine, you know we're in state X. What happens if I get a vote commit in this state? What happens if I get a vote abort? What happens if I get a commit, global commit? You can just enumerate all the messages and say, make sure it makes sense. And this avoids issues of like not knowing what a message does or having a message do something that doesn't make sense. Like you can check for that. So here's the state machine for the coordinator. So I have four states. I have init, which is just where we start. We don't actually stay there for any amount of time. I have waiting, and I have aborted and committed. And the way these states are going to work are that whenever we're in a state, whenever we switch to a state, the first thing we're going to do, I'm either the coordinator or the workers, we're going to write down in our log, I am in this, the waiting state, or I am in the aborted state. And this means that if we come back up, we're going to repeat the actions of entering that state and resend those messages and so on. And I have our transitions listed here. So we start out in init, and to go to the waiting state, as we go to the waiting state, we send out our prepare messages. Then we're in the waiting state, and if we receive any abort messages, we go to the aborted state and send everyone abort messages. If we're in the waiting state and we receive enough agree to commit messages, we send everyone a commit message. And as we go to abort or committed, we record that. So if we fail and come back up, we go back to saying, okay, I failed, I came back up and aborted. I'm going to resend all those abort messages just in case I didn't get to finish that. And we come up and committed, I'm going to resend all those commit messages just in case I didn't finish that. So in the waiting state, we accumulate the votes. Another thing we do that I'm not showing, this is not like a complete diagram, like a full state diagram would have all the actions, all the messages, but that would take up all the room in this slide and more. So in the waiting state, we're gonna have to deal with failures of workers or the network. So one thing we'll do is we'll resend those prepare messages after a timeout. And this is a general pattern we'll have, is that we'll resend messages after a timeout if we don't get a response saying it got there. And similarly, if we get a vote from a worker in the aborted state, so the worker thought we didn't get its vote, or we're gonna resend the aborted message to the worker. We're just gonna be fine. We're just gonna tell the worker, oh, you must have forgotten that, you must have gone down. That's okay, the transaction's aborted, now you know. And if the worker resends the vote in the commit message, we're gonna resend the commit, hey, everyone committed. You should do that too. And this is how we're gonna deal with workers failing and coming back up. They're gonna resend their votes. We're gonna send back a message. Or if workers are worried that their message didn't get there, they can resend their vote and we'll send back the reply for what actually happened. And as I said, the coordinator has a log indicating the last state, and if any sort of messages don't get there, people can just resend them after a timeout. We're going to deal with duplicates of messages because we know what machines they came from, what transaction they're for. We're going to figure out how duplicates work in the correct way without confusing ourselves. So, questions about this state machine? Yeah. So yes, whenever a machine fails, it's going to repeat the last state it has written in this log and do the things to enter that state. Yeah?
When does the coordinator exit the aborted or committed states?
So when does the coordinator exit the aborted or committed state? In this diagram, never. In practice, we're going to have to do some work to figure out, did everyone know that the transaction's aborted or committed and have that in their log, and then we can do it. Other questions? And I guess something I noticed that, like, conceptually, so the way I've done this, we're doing exactly one transaction. In a real system, we do multiple of these in parallel, and each one would have their own state machine. So we'd have like a whole bunch of transactions at the same time. Each one has their own state machine doing the same thing on each machine. So that's the coordinator. The worker state machine is like this. So we start in the init phase and we receive a prepare. And either we figure out I can do that and we agree to commit, send that reply back, or we figure out I can't do that and we agree to abort. So we have two states. We have this agree to commit state where we're waiting for that commit message. And if we receive the commit, we actually commit the transaction and go to the committed state, remembering that we did that. If we receive the report message, we go to the aborted state and do that. Similarly, if we decide to abort the transaction, we can just be in the aborted state because we know the outcome of the transaction is going to be it won't happen. Because that's how aborting works, that it has to be unanimous to commit. So that's how the worker works. And then we can generally do this thing where, so if we're stuck in init, the coordinator is going to resend the prepare message for us. If we're stuck in agree to commit or abort and we're worried that the coordinator isn't working, we can resend our vote and ask for a reply if we're worried about that. Or if we come back up and agree to commit, or we can resend our vote. And if we come back up and aborted, we can resend our vote to abort. And know that that's fine. Okay. So those are state machines, and that's typically how we'll specify protocols. I didn't specify a full state machine, so really we want to specify what happens in every message. Like, we want to specify what happens if I'm init and I receive an abort message out of nowhere. What should I do? And the answer is I should go to abort it. If I receive a commit message out of nowhere and I'm init, what should I do? Well, the answer is something went really wrong because I didn't vote for that, or I forgot my vote, so something's broken. But when you're doing this protocol in practice, you'll want to do that exercise of enumerating what are all the possible things that could happen, even the ones that don't make sense. And ideally, you want to prove, for example, that it's not possible, assuming things fail the way we expect, for us to receive a commit message in the init state. And it's not possible for us to receive a commit message in the aborted state. So I'm going to be quick about this. So our normal operation with what we put together is that we do a transaction. The coordinator sends prepare messages to the workers. The workers send back these agree to commit messages. And then the coordinator figures out, yep, everyone voted for it, and send back the, hey, everyone committed. And in the process, before everyone sends their messages, they log, hey, I'm in this state. I'm in the wait state. I'm in the agree to commit state. I'm in the commit state. Everyone logs what state they're in. So if they go down, they'll come back up and know what messages to send. And in our case where we have a conflict, so we have like a motion to agree to abort, works similarly that the coordinator figures out that we abort. Everyone logs their states in the same way. And so, and let's say we have a failure. So here I try to prepare a transaction, I agree to commit, a worker fails, and in this case, let's say the worker didn't manage to actually process the transaction, it comes back up, it can figure out what to do. So, it can just abort it when it receives a message from the coordinator. I probably should have drawn that. So the coordinator resends prepare, and it says, well, I don't know about that. I'm just going to abort it. That's one option for dealing with it. It could also figure it out again and commit it. That's a way of dealing with it. Or it could record that it agreed to commit beforehand and managed to commit it when it comes back up. So, any questions on this general procedure? Okay, so that's two-phase commit. So, we deal with all the failures, sending messages, And basically the idea is that this is a way of coordinating voting, and the way we made it work so everyone seems to do everything at the same time is by having this sort of waiting state while we're preparing, when we pause operations, when we like lock the course, while maybe we're gonna add some student to it, maybe we're not, depending on whether the student record machine allows that or vice versa. So any questions on two-phase commit before I talk about an extension just very briefly? Okay, so two-phase commit works on this unanimous vote to commit assumption. And this makes sense for the case where we have data split across nodes and we want to change the data across all the nodes and different nodes have different data, so everyone has to cooperate. There's another common use case where every node has a copy of the data. And we want to work despite a few failing nodes. We want to have the data continue to be available despite the few failing nodes. So rather than having the student and courses split up, we have them all together, but we have like three copies of it, and I want to continue working as long as I have any one of those copies, or any two of those copies. And we just want to require enough nodes to be working. So in this case, rather than just having our vote be unanimous, that everyone agrees to do something, we're going to require what we call a quorum. So here I have five nodes, and I'm going to say they all have copies of my data. And in order to do an operation, you know, I'm going to have require a quorum. In this case, I'm going to say my quorum is three nodes. So if A, C, and D agree to do something, I'm going to say that's enough. I don't care that B and E aren't talking to me. They might be down, but I don't need them. I have copies of the data on A, C, and D, and that's good enough. And the idea is that B and E are going to figure this out later. When they come back up, they'll figure out what happened. They have plenty of machines to learn it from. It's going to be fine. And the way we make quorums work is that we have this requirement that quorums overlap. And this is how we give consistency. So everyone who agreed to do the transaction, in this case I'm requiring three nodes to agree, and the reason I chose three for this is that I have five machines in total. Any set of two sets of three nodes overlap in at least one node. So here, let's say I made A, B, and C agree to do something, and C, D, and E agree to do something. I know that those operations don't conflict because C agreed to do both of them. So I know I didn't make my course go over capacity because C said you could add the student both times, so the course must not be over capacity. Yeah?
So A, B, and D were the ones that didn't fail. Would that not work?
So if A, B, and D were the ones, so if we had another thing where we had A, B, and D, yeah, so there's extra work about, so there's some details I'm omitting about how do we deal with that if we have three quorums, they don't all overlap. And the way we're going to deal with that in practice is that one of the things we're going to update is we're going to keep track of, like, we're going to have to keep track of not just, you know, have to keep track of like what the total number of students in the course is and make sure that's consistent. So if like that's what we're updating to, we don't have to worry. But there's extra details there about what we actually have to have updated. Or we have to somehow verify, more likely what we're doing is we're going to verify, hey, the last thing I did to the course was this, make sure you agree on that. That's usually what we're actually going to do, is we're going to keep track of the last operation into the course was this one, and everyone has to agree on, and by having a quorum, we guarantee that someone should know about the most recent operation, because we have that overlap. Yeah?
So you have multiple times?
So every machine votes, so the idea is that the blue is that we did two writes. So let's say blue was add student A, green was add student B to course, and each of those had their own vote, And the idea is that it's okay because we know that we have the latest version of the course because C is going to remember the latest version of the course. I'm going to make sure that if something bad is happening, it's going to say, sorry, I can't do that. I can't add student B because you're trying to add it to the wrong version of the course with the wrong student count. That's not going to work. So we have this student, so we have this C which can remember, figure out, oh, this is that last thing which happened, not what you A and B think it is. Yeah, so they figure it out because C is going to remember,
So there has to be another vote has to happen for like everybody to be on the same page.
So I'm going to gloss over some issues of how we get everyone on the same page. The usual idea is that let's say we did the blue quorum first, then we try to do the green thing. C is going to say, hey, D and E, this is the latest version of things, not what you got. And because C is there to do that, D and E are going to get updated, so we'll still be able to survive C failing later on. Does that make sense?
But then what if the green vote never happens?
If the green vote never happens, then, well, A, B, and C still remember it until some vote's going to happen after the blue vote. And things will eventually be okay. The actual reasoning to prove that this works out and the details of making it happen are things I'm glossing over, and there's lots and lots of super tricky details, which would be like two extra lectures of stuff.
But we have to wait for another vote for everything to be consistent.
So with what I'm describing, we have to wait for another vote for everything to be consistent. In practice, we're going to be more proactive than that. That it's not going to be the normal case that we actually do stuff without everybody. That this is the unusual case where things are broken. And the normal case is that everyone's working, or most people are working. But the key idea, and maybe it's going to be clearer here, but the key idea of the quorum is that C knows about latest version, can tell D and E about it. That's like the key idea, is that because there's this overlap, C knows what A and B did, it can tell D and E about it and vice versa. And that's why we need overlap. So that guarantees that every time we agree to do something, someone voted who knew what the latest thing that happened was and can make sure everyone is on the same page with that. And that's the basic idea of how we're going to make this work. So sometimes, and this might make it clearer, we vary the quorum based on the operation type. So for example, we might decide that for updates, which I'm depicting in blue here, we do require 4 or 5 nodes, and for reads we require 2. This is okay because we guarantee that any 2 updates overlap. And we guarantee that an update and a read overlaps, even though 2 reads don't overlap, but that's fine, because reads don't change anything. We just need to guarantee that when you read, you see one of the latest versions. Something to note that's implied from here is that with this system, reads require votes. Because some machine might be behind, we need to get a vote to know, is a student in the course? Because otherwise we might be asking someone who's out of date. But you see the idea of where we need the overlap. So, other questions? So this is a very high level description. The details are really tricky. Like we have the same sort of state machine things, but the failure cases are a lot trickier. As was alluded to with the questions, we need to deal with what do we actually, like we can't actually do like our conflicts in the same way we do with two-phase commit. We need to be much stricter about what gets updated to make sure things get consistent. Coordinator failures are an issue. Like here, it's not acceptable to say if the coordinator fails, we don't do the transaction, we have to still do it. So you have to do the transaction despite the coordinator going away. If you want the full details, look up Raft or Paxos, which are protocols which are commonly used to do this with failstop. And people also do this for Byzantine failures, but quorums aren't enough. And the problem with a quorum is that nodes can give inconsistent answers. So in the case where I have my C here, C can tell D and E, hey, there are 15 students in this class. I can tell A and B, hey, there are 17 students in this class. Because that's a type of failure Byzantine failures can have. So quorums aren't enough to deal with the issue. So because nodes can tell people inconsistent things, they can agree to commit in inconsistent ways. And to solve this problem in practice, basically what you need to do is you have the same vote to commit abort sort of thing. And you need to confirm with other nodes that, hey, did C vote this way for you? And you should get that with enough other nodes that you're confident that C is usually voting that way enough that things are okay, as long as not too many nodes are lying to you. This gets really complicated to implement. This is why we have this 3F plus 1 result. If you want the full details, look up PBFT, which stands for Practical Byzantine Fault Tolerance, which is a paper which describes how to do this. In practice, this is not used very much, this type of tolerance, partly because, well, we have a lot of extra nodes to handle it. We need 4 nodes to handle 1 failure. It's pretty complicated to implement. The protocol in this paper, at least avoids having n squared messages, which is not obvious how to do, but it's still pretty expensive. And you have to think about what types of failures does this deal with. If all the nodes are running the same software and that software has a bug, well, they're all going to fail together if it's a software bug. So people don't always like using it because they don't think it deals with the failures they care about. So any other questions about this consensus? Distributed consensus stuff, which is what I'm talking about. Yeah?
What would it be if we were doing quorum instead of the unanimous voting?
So the reason we were doing quorum instead of unanimous voting was that with two-phase commit, our assumption was the data is split, so we need to update everyone's data in order to do anything. Here, our assumption is everyone has a copy of the data, and we want to deal with nodes, we want to have the system continue to work if nodes fail. So an example of this is that if you're Google, you want Google Drive to continue to give you the same data, even if a data center loses power. And this is something they actually use this type of thing for. So that if a data center loses power, Google wants to continue to have the same data for your data. And they can guarantee that with this kind of design. Okay, so our next topic, which we're going to spend most of next time on, is going to be on security and protection. So these are two different things. So protection in this class is going to mean mechanisms for controlling access to resources. And we've seen these, page tables control access to physical memory. Scheduling controls access to the CPU. And you can think of encryption as controlling access to data in sort of a way. And security is we're using protection to prevent misuse. And misuse is this vague concept that in this class I'm not going to talk about much. But there's some policy about what's bad, what ways we want to allow people to access data. And in this class, I'm going to talk about the mechanisms more than the policy. So I'm going to say, there's some policy, I'm going to talk about how we specify policies, but I'm not going to talk about what's a good policy, what's a bad policy. I'm going to talk about what the operating system does for protection, or things like operating systems, which is, it's going to implement these mechanisms that hopefully you can configure for whatever policy you care about. That if you don't certain people accessing this file. You can configure the mechanism to make that happen. We're going to talk about what that mechanism looks like. And the goal is that our mechanisms provide enough flexibility that the policies we care about are possible to specify with those mechanisms. So, questions on this concept? So, something to note when we're talking about security generally is that security is about adversaries. And like Byzantine failures, adversaries do the worst possible thing. So it's not going to be enough for us to look at typical behavior. So like if we're worried about controlling access to the CPU, we can't look at what's the mean wait time. That's not a security thing. We have to think of what's the worst possible thing the adversary is going to do, what's that situation going to look like, not what's a typical situation. So we're going to look for guarantees, not sort of this thing usually works out. And since we're controlling who has access to resources, and we're usually talking about some notion of bad people not having access to resources, we need to talk about identifying who is running. So there's two notions we're going to talk about. So one is authentication. So authentication is figuring out the person in front of the machine is Joe. Authorization is deciding, okay, I know who's in front of the machine, what can they do? And in this class, we're mostly going to talk about authorization. And you'll see why. We're going to just say that authentication is someone else's problem, and this is how most operating systems work, actually. Most operating systems, the kernel doesn't actually deal with authentication. It just has a way of letting other programs deal with authentication, and I'll talk about the mechanism for that in a bit. But we're going to deal with authorization, that we're going to be told who's running, and we need to figure out what can we let them do. And sort of one abstract representation we can look at for what can people do is that is this something called an access control matrix. And we're going to have a bunch of what we'll call protection domains. This is the actual term from the original paper that introduced this. And the idea is that processes which are running on behalf of someone belong to protection domains, which represent things like users, groups of users, so like user, you know, my username, the CS faculty group, and we specify for each of these domains, these users or groups of users or whatever else we want to divide processes into, what resources they're supposed to access, where we have this giant table where we say for each file, for each process, and so on, what operations are allowed if you're in this protection domain. And we'll talk about sort of ways of representing this next time and go on to some other security-related topics.